Today is Friday, March 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, a ceasefire in Syria's war-torn Idlib province holds, for now.
I think that there isn't a great deal of optimism that this is anything other than a temporary agreement.
Plus, a deadly attack in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and why climate change threatens Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Those stories and more are next. Our top story today, a ceasefire in Syria's rebel stronghold of Idlib, bordering Turkey, went into effect today after being signed by Turkish and Russian leaders in Moscow Thursday. VOA's Ayan Bior has the story.
Syria's war-ravaged northwest Idlib province woke up to relative calm this Friday, following a Russian-Turkish ceasefire deal signed in Moscow Thursday between Russia and Turkey. The agreement raised hopes of an end to one of the bloodiest phases in the conflict. Since December, a Russian-backed government offensive on the last rebel bastion in the country has killed hundreds of civilians and displaced close to a million people. The assault had drawn in thousands of Turkish troops to block the government assault, raising fears of confrontation between Turkey and Moscow. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights Monitoring Group said there was, quote, a complete absence of regime and Russian warplanes in the Idlib airspace, end quote. But the monitoring group noted that an exchange of fire before dawn killed six government fighters and nine members of a jihadi group. European and UN officials welcomed the Moscow deal and said they hoped to see a lasting cessation of hostilities, but Idlib's war-weary residents had low expectations. Here's Yusuf Al-Grebi, a displaced man from Syria's Jabal al-Zawiya area. He said, it's something well known that after all the sacrifices that we've given, after all the bombing and the deaths, after the massacres, that this can't be solved through politics. It announces a truce, and 2 days later, at the most, the truce is completely over. Adnan Imam, displaced from Anadan, Aleppo, voiced similar concerns. He said, regarding the truce and whether the regime will respect it or not, judging from our experience over the past 10 years, we know that the regime will first make gains and take new areas, then it will stop, arrange a truce, and get itself in order to reform its planes or reform its troops, and then relaunch again and make new gains. The agreement is supposed to create a security corridor along a key highway in northern Syria, where Turkish and Russian forces are to launch joint patrols later this month. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
For more on prospects for this ceasefire, earlier today I spoke to journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Here's what he had to say.
Yes, since the announcement of this ceasefire, what we understand from reports is the situation is very tense in Idlib. There has been one report of one major confrontation between Syrian regime forces and a jihadist group that resulted in the deaths of at least 15 people. But that seems to be the only major violation of the ceasefire. And it's unclear in the details of the ceasefire agreement whether jihadist groups are included in that. Other than that, the situation is pretty peaceful at the moment, although it has to be said there is a lot of nervousness and feelings at how long the ceasefire is sustainable for.
There have been some comments by different Syrian civilians in Idlib, and they have been very critical even of the peace deal, basically saying, look, we've seen so many peace deals before, and or I should say ceasefires before, and they've always been broken. Is there any indication that this time could be different?
I think that there isn't a great deal of optimism that this is anything other than a temporary agreement. There's been criticism of the fact that this agreement doesn't seem to have any political dimension to it, no talk or ideas about turning a ceasefire into something more permanent, possibly a political solution. And that's something Ankara has been pressing very hard for. But Moscow, supporting Damascus, insists that this ultimately, this civil war can be ended by militarily. They believe victory is within the grasp of Damascus. They believe the rebels are facing complete defeat and have given little interest or support to Ankara's idea of a political settlement. And that's why I think the feeling, at least at the moment, is that this ceasefire agreement is nothing more than a temporary affair. And it's also been criticized of the fact that there's no talk of many of the people that have been displaced by the recent fighting, something in the region of nearly a million people. No talk in the agreement of how those people can return.
And then looking at Europe, so Ankara in particular has been putting a lot of pressure on Europe to get more involved, whether that's in terms of the humanitarian side in Turkey or on the border, but also in terms of calls for a no-fly zone and other things in Idlib itself. How has Europe reacted to this deal? Europe has been observing, of course, but they haven't. They weren't part of the deal itself.
Europe is watching extremely closely this deal, and particularly because they have a refugee crisis right on their border since Turkey announced the opening of its border to its refugees. It has caught the attention of Europe's leaders that there is this refugee crisis in Turkey and the potential that it can get a lot worse. Ankara has been warning that if this ceasefire doesn't hold, then they could be facing another million, possibly 2 million more refugees fleeing from Idlib into Turkey. And Ankara has made that perfectly clear. If that is going to happen, then it's going to be a European problem, not just a Turkey one, and they will push those refugees onwards into Europe. But that's why I think the European leaders have been talking about backing Ankara's idea of making this ceasefire permanent, creating a safe haven, protected by a no-fly zone. The German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, has been voicing support of this idea. And I think this is what Ankara's plan going forward is, to build up international momentum for the idea of creating a permanent safe haven with a no-fly zone. The problem Ankara faces is, at the moment, its Western allies, be it in Europe or probably more importantly Washington, there's little enthusiasm for deploying any kind of force that brings a risk of confrontation with Russian forces in Syria.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. Now, Greek and Turkish first security forces again deployed tear gas on Friday as refugees stuck between the two sides tried to cross into Greece. European Union leaders pleaded with migrants on the Turkish border to stop trying to cross into Greece. Tens of thousands of people have been trying to get into Greece, which is an EU member state, since Turkey said on February 28th that it would no longer try to keep them in the country, given the looming crisis in Idlib. Turkey agreed in 2016 with the EU to block refugees from going to Europe in return for billions of euros in payment. Turkey, which hosts nearly 4 million refugees, says the EU has failed to honor its earlier promises. There was no indication the EU would allow migrants to enter from Turkey, as EU ministers who were meeting in Croatia instead hinted at possibly sending more aid to Ankara. But they also said they were ready to take, quote, all necessary measures, end quote, to stop illegal crossings into Greece. Now, the latest in the COVID-19 outbreak. The number of people infected with coronavirus around the world surpassed 100,000 on Friday. The outbreak has killed more than 3,400 people and spread across more than 90 nations, with six countries reporting their first cases on Friday, including the Netherlands and Cameroon. The virus has radiated across the United States, surfacing in at least four new states, plus San Francisco. Now, as the COVID-19 outbreak spreads, so do myths and rumors about the virus. Here at VOA, we want to tackle those rumors head-on so that you, our listeners, have the best, most up-to-date information about the disease. Today, we start a new series where we hear from trusted health experts to address the truth about the many myths and rumors spreading by word of mouth and on social media about the COVID-19 coronavirus. Today's topic, where does the virus come from and how does it actually spread? To find out, I spoke with Dr. Elizabeth Radin, who is an epidemiologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Here's a clip of our conversation. One of the first things with this COVID-19 virus that people are worried about is where they can get it from. So there's a bunch of myths about where you can get this from. Some people are saying that you can get it from your pets. Some people are worried that any contact with anything from China, whether it's mail or packages that have been sent by China or from Chinese restaurants. Can you clear up, you know, where does this virus really come from and how does it actually transmit between people or to people?
Sure. So probably the best way, as you said, to tackle those myths is to go back to what is this virus, where does it come from, and how, what is the science on how it's actually spread. So the virus that is causing the current COVID-19 outbreak is a beta coronavirus, which is a family of viruses that have their origins in bats. And rarely we see that a new coronavirus can cross over from the animal population to the human population. That's what we understand happened in China with the virus causing the current outbreak. Interestingly, scientists believe that this outbreak of the virus has come from a single recent emergence from an animal reservoir. Now, how on earth would they know that? Well, actually, what they can do is look at the virus that's showing up in patients at the U.S., look at the genetic sequence of that virus, and compare it to the genetic sequence of the original virus from China. We see very, very little difference between those two. Allow scientists to essentially construct a family tree showing that this is really a recent crossover and also likely coming from a single virus. So that's our best understanding of where this virus came from. We have seen this type of coronavirus in the past, most notably with the SARS outbreak in 2003 and the more recent MERS outbreak. So that's where the virus came from. There's, you know, strong theory, strong science behind that.
Another myth out there is that this virus was leaked from a secret lab in Wuhan, and it's escaped. It was created by the government, and now they're trying to cover it up by claiming it's an outbreak.
There's really no evidence for this explanation or idea that it came from a lab. That would make for good movie material, but there's no science or historical evidence behind that. In terms of how it's spreading currently, the spread is primarily person to person. We've seen this since the early days of the outbreak in China, and it continues now. What does that mean? It means that the virus can be spread through close contact, and that means sustained contact of less than 6 feet between two people. And it's spread through respiratory droplets, so tiny droplets that come out when someone coughs or sneezes that can be come in contact with someone else's nose, mouth, or possibly inhaled into the lungs. There's some possibility that the virus could also be spread by surfaces. So if those respiratory droplets get on a surface, someone else touches that surface and then touches their face, that's a possible mode of spread, but it's believed that the majority of transmission we're seeing is from close person-to-person contact. So that means there's no reason to think you could get this from your pets at this point. The restaurant explanation is far-fetched and really implausible. And from what we know, it's really that close person-to-person contact.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Radin, an epidemiologist at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health in New York. Tune in to our next installment of this series on VOA's International Edition on Monday, when Dr. Radin will tackle rumors about who is at risk. Pope Francis on Friday accepted the resignation of a French cardinal who was convicted and then acquitted of covering up for a pedophile priest in a case that fueled a reckoning over Catholic Church sexual abuse in France. Lyon Cardinal Philippe Barbarin, 69, had been accused of failing to report the Reverend Bernard Prenat to civil authorities when he learned of his abuse. Prenat, who is now on trial, has confessed to molesting at least 75 boys in the 1970s and 80s. Two suicide bombers blew themselves up near the U.S. Embassy in Tunisia, killing a police officer and wounding four others Friday. Tunisia's interior ministry said hundreds of police swarmed around the embassy on the outskirts of the Tunisian capital, Tunis, after the bombings. An interior ministry spokesman insisted the dead attackers had targeted the officers on patrol and not the U.S. Embassy. And coming up later...
If we can stabilize the climate, we can allow the Great Barrier Reef time to recover and hopefully one day reach its former glory.
You're listening to VOA News.
This weekend, tune into Music Time in Africa. Hey, everybody, I'm Heather Maxwell. I've got an exciting playlist of amazing tunes from Morocco, Ghana, Ethiopia, Benin, South Africa, Nigeria, Gambia, and Tanzania. You'll also meet Kenyan singer-songwriter Dan Aseda. He just released his new album, Benganology, and Bill Odidi gets him to talk about it and play a few fresh samples.
The kind of traditional, classic
song of the week from Gabon is Yaya Yobe, a gorgeous tune by Chanel Lakinda. Le feu, le feu, le feu. Kwame Ofori joins me to present that. And finally, my vintage tune is polyphonic music from the rainforests of Central African Republic. Don't miss it. Music Time in Africa, 1505 and 20500 Universal Time.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. In Afghanistan, officials said at least 32 people were killed and dozens more injured Friday when gunmen opened fire at a gathering in Kabul attended by high-profile opposition politicians. Witnesses said the shooting started when former Vice President Karim Khalili was delivering a speech that was being broadcast live on television. Former Vice President Khalili escaped unharmed, as did Afghan Chief Executive Abdullah Abdullah and former President Hamid Karzai, who were both also at Friday's event. But a former provincial governor was said to be one among those wounded. The attack comes nearly a week after the Taliban signed a major deal with the U.S. to end 19 years of fighting between the two groups. However, the Taliban insurgency swiftly denied any involvement in Friday's attack. For more, earlier today I spoke with VOA correspondent Ayaz Ghul in Kabul. Here's what he had to say.
What we just have from the Afghan Interior Ministry is that the three attackers who assaulted this public gathering in Kabul have been neutralized. They have been killed. We don't have any claims of responsibility, but this attack happened actually in a Shiite-dominated part of the Afghan capital. There have been attacks in this area previously, and it's the Islamic State affiliate, the Khorasan province, has claimed responsibility for those attacks. So this could be the work of Islamic State, but we don't have any official claims yet. And we also know that the Taliban insurgency instantly distanced itself from the violence, saying they had nothing to do with it. But it was quite a high-profile attack in a way that we had the Afghan chief executive, Abdullah Abdullah, former President Hamid Karzai, and several other prominent political figures who were there. It was a ceremony to commemorate the death of one Shia Afghan leader who was assassinated in 1995. So all these politicians had gathered to address this rally when, from a building under construction nearby the rally, these three gunmen opened fire and used some rockets. It is confirmed now that all these high-profile Afghan politicians, they were unharmed and they quickly were taken out of the rally. But it definitely is a strong indication that even though the United States has signed recently a peace agreement with the Taliban to try to bring an end to these hostilities in Afghanistan, which have been continuing for 19 years, there are elements who would continue to create problems.
Now, looking at that agreement, tomorrow, Saturday, will be 1 week since it was signed. Has this deal held? Have expectations been met?
The agreement was signed on Saturday, and there was really big expectation that finally the process has begun toward ending this conflict in Afghanistan. But then, within 24 hours, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani came out and said that he was not supposed to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners that was promised by this peace agreement. So that was the first setback. And then the Taliban came out and they said that if their prisoners were not released, the intra-Afghan negotiations would not start. But then the U.S. official came out and they said that, you know, they were expecting these kind of political sort of gimmickry or statements from these stakeholders in the agreement. But in the meantime, Taliban launched major attacks in different parts of the country. That prompted the United States military to carry out a major airstrike in southern Afghanistan a day before yesterday against the Taliban, saying that because the Taliban fighters were trying to attack Afghan security forces and the U.S. military is bound to support Afghan security forces. We hope that within the next 3-4 days, there could be some kind of an announcement from the Afghan government, because it has to establish or create a negotiating team that would talk to the Taliban to permanently end hostilities and a power-sharing agreement once foreign forces leave the country.
There was this reduction in violence period before the agreement was signed. In terms of fighting between the U.S. and the Taliban, has that remained at a low level?
On Wednesday, there was a testimony, a congressional hearing, where Defense Secretary Mark Esper even acknowledged that there has been no attack between the U.S.-led foreign forces and the Taliban, and that the Taliban were also living up to their commitments of not carrying out any suicide bombings or other attacks in all the 34 provincial capitals in Afghanistan, as per the understanding between the two sides. So that is in place. We also understand that the Taliban came out, said that this U.S. airstrike was not a violation of the mutual reduction in violence between the U.S. military and the Taliban. So both the sides have publicly gone to acknowledge that whatever has happened over the last few days, it does not breach the peace agreement they signed a week ago. So it appears that the United States is determined and the Taliban are determined to carry forward this understanding that they have signed. But what we don't know yet, whether Afghan stakeholders will finally come to the negotiating table and, you know, agree on some kind of a power-sharing understanding.
That was VOA correspondent Ayaz Ghul in Kabul. Coral reefs are some of Earth's most important underwater ecosystems. The brightly colored habitats harbor thousands of fish species and other sea creatures, providing food, medicine, and more for people around the world. But reefs around the globe are threatened by so-called, quote, bleaching events, end quote, when the colorful coral structures die off and lose their color. The world's biggest reef, the Great Barrier Reef off Australia's east coast, is facing one of its most widespread coral bleaching events on record. Scientists say climate change is to blame. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The world's largest reef system has only just begun to recover after being hit by two consecutive years of coral bleaching in 2016 and 2017. On Heron Island in Queensland, researchers say that the mass bleaching of coral has got worse in recent weeks. They're adamant that climate change is to blame for warmer ocean temperatures. The southern part of the Great Barrier Reef should be an array of pinks and purples, but is instead a ghostly white. Coral responds to excessive heat by expelling the algae that give them their brilliant colours and most of their energy. When a coral bleaches, it's not dead, but it becomes far more stressed and fragile. Aaron Chai is a marine biologist at the University of Queensland.
The mass bleaching has intensified over the last month. The reef that is normally coloured in browns, pinks, blues and purples is stark white. Looking at what is happening on the reef currently, I'm afraid that the future effects we simulate in our experiments could be occurring now as we speak. If we can stabilize the climate, we can allow the Great Barrier Reef time to recover and hopefully one day reach its former glory.
Australian scientists fear the bleaching could be more widespread than in 2016 and 17, but hopefully it won't be as damaging. The Great Barrier Reef is estimated to support more than 60,000 jobs and generate $6.4 billion to the Australian economy. The reef runs 2,300 kilometres down Australia's northeastern coast and spans an area about the size of Japan. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A military helicopter carrying foreign diplomats crashed in eastern Myanmar on Friday afternoon, injuring two pilots, a military spokesman said. Several military attachés were on board the helicopter bound for the commercial capital of Yangon when it crashed shortly after taking off from Luekan village in northern Shan State. They had attended a press briefing in the area where authorities recently seized $37 million worth of narcotics, chemicals, and equipment. It was not immediately clear whether anyone other than the pilots were injured. Myanmar is the world's biggest producer of methamphetamine, and authorities are often keen to show large-scale seizures to the media. That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our director, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.